our headlines. The EU and Russia welcomed the new deal between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, calling for the resumption of 2015 nuclear deal revival talks. Israeli airstrikes target different parts of the Gaza Strip, pounding the east of Rafah city several times. Also, North Korea carries out long-range cruise missile tests, describing its missile capability as, quote, deterrence against hostile forces. Hello and welcome from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says a recent agreement between Iran and the agency solved a, quote, major communication breakdown with Tehran. Rafael Grossi said the agreement would allow the IAEA inspectors to service its monitoring cameras at Iranian nuclear sites. He added that the agreement meant the agency had, quote, continuity of knowledge. Piawer added that the agreement was not a permanent solution and was only a stopgap that would buy time for more diplomacy.
Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has made a day-long visit to Tehran. During his short visit, he met with the new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The Iranian official hailed the constructive talks he held with the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference after the meeting, Islami described the negotiations, mainly on technical issues, as constructive and said confidence building is what matters for Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog.
Today, Mr. Grossi came to Tehran at the invitation of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and we had good and constructive talks. The negotiations were held in a spirit of cooperation to create opportunities for enhanced interactions within the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency's rules and regulations. Mr. Grossi will visit Tehran again in the near future, and the IAEA's technical team will also come to Iran to make necessary arrangements for the replacement of surveillance camera memory cards in accordance with the safeguards agreement.
But I'm glad to say that today we were able to have a very concrete result, which has to do with the continuity of the operation of the agency's equipment here, which is indispensable for us to provide the necessary guarantees and the information to the IAEA and to the world that everything is in order and that we are going to be able to assist Iran in its future negotiations in the context of the JCPOA.
Back in February, Iran and the IAEA reached a technical understanding under which Tehran agreed to keep the camera recordings from its nuclear sites for 3 months as a goodwill gesture in support of diplomacy, waiting to see whether the other parties to the JCPOA could manage to bring the U.S. back into full compliance with the deal. The agreements came shortly after Iran decided to stop its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections in Iran, denying the agency's inspectors access to the country's nuclear facilities beyond the safeguards agreement. The decision was made in accordance with the December 2020 law passed by the Iranian parliament, dubbed a strategic action plan to counter sanctions that prompted the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iranian officials have cautioned the IAEA Board of Governors to avoid miscalculations at its upcoming meeting, warning that taking advantage of the IAEA for political purposes will draw a different response from Tehran. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
The European Union has welcomed the outcome of the International Atomic Energy Agency chief's visit to Iran. In a tweet, Enrique Mora, the bloc's negotiator for talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, said Rafael Grossi's visit has given space for diplomacy. He noted that the EU aims for full implementation of the accord. His comments were echoed by Russia's permanent representative to the international organizations in Vienna, Mikhail Ulyanov. The Russian diplomat called for the resumption of the talks, which currently appear to have stalled. Malevsky joined us earlier with more details on the outcome of the IAEA chief's visit to Tehran.
And he described his trip as very constructive, saying that there was an immediate and urgent issue that needed to be addressed, and the good news is, as far as the agency is concerned, is that that issue has been, in his words, rectified, meaning that the agency can continue to have the knowledge and the data and information that it needs if it doesn't want there to be a gap in the continuity of knowledge. The Director General, in his latest reports, raised serious concerns about this, leading to speculations that the IAEA board would actually go ahead with a resolution against the country that would, in its turn, jeopardize the JCPOA resumption talks that have been halted for the time being. So it looks like now, you know, when Mr. Grossi was asked whether the developments in Iran mean that the agency would indeed decide not to go ahead with the resolution, whether the board will not go ahead with the resolution, Mr. Grossi said that he has already given this complimentary information to the IAEA board to consider, and that he believes that with this additional information that the agency has provided to the board, this will, of course, influence the decision that the members of the board will make.
Iran has welcomed two naval vessels that have come back from a long mission to the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean. The mission marks Iran's first naval journey across far-flung seas. Youssef Jalali reports from the city of Bandar Abbas.
Iran's fully indigenous Sahand frigate and Makran floating base are back in the Persian Gulf after more than 4 months of sailing that took them as far as the northern end of the Atlantic Ocean, over a distance of 44,000 kilometers. The naval crew were warmly welcomed by senior military officials who feel proud that Iran's Navy is now capable of sailing in the high sea for extended periods.
We passed through three oceans, the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic, and North Atlantic Ocean. On the way, we passed through rough seas and finally arrived in Russia's St. Petersburg port. We then sailed all the way back home. All the mission took us some 4.5 months. This is the farthest point we have ever sailed to.
Sahand Frigate is a radar-evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. And Makran Floating Base is a support vessel that's fitted with a large helicopter pad. Sahand and Makran departed from the Persian Gulf in early May. The two ships passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and sailed through the North Atlantic Ocean to reach Russia, all without docking for refueling on the way.
Throughout our journey, we did not stop to refuel or recharge our medical or food supplies. We went straight to our destination. We had our support vessel Makran along with Sahand that refueled it along the way. It sends a strong message to our enemies, especially the U.S., which tried to play down our naval might.
Iran's defense sector has been under 4 decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. Iranian officials say they have viewed the sanctions as an opportunity to gain self-sufficiency in the industry. Iran now claims that it has indigenized more than 80% of its arsenal, from drones and helicopters to warships and submarines.
The Iranian Navy is back from the longest voyage in its history. To Iran, sailing through the Atlantic Ocean was a game-changer for two reasons. First, it shows that the country can rely on its domestically built equipment for tough naval missions amid U.S. arms embargoes. And most importantly, it adds Iran to the short list of countries with a blue water navy. Youssef Jalali from the Persian Gulf.
Palestinian media say Israeli aircraft have targeted several areas across the Gaza Strip. Positions belonging to Palestinian resistance east of the city of Rafah and Khan Yunis have reportedly been hit several times. There was no immediate word on any possible casualties or damage. The attacks come less than a day after the regime's warplanes pounded targets in Rafah and in the west of Khan Yunis. The spokesman for the Palestinian president says the issue of the prisoners is exemplary of the unity of the people. Nabil Abu Rudayne called the Palestinian prisoners the heroes of the people, adding that they are as scared or as sacred as Al-Quds. He was referring to the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli detention and also the 6 inmates who escaped the prison of Gilboa last week. Earlier, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation condemned the Israeli regime's repressive measures against Palestinian prisoners. According to the OIC's Human Rights Commission, many Palestinian inmates are kept in solitary confinement and their access to essential services has been restricted. The military wing of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas vows to release the rearrested Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail on Monday. It also stressed that resistance against the Israeli occupation will go on. Ruba Shabat reports from Gaza.
Abu Ubaida, spokesman for the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, pledged in a speech to release the prisoners who were rearrested after escaping from an Israeli jail on Monday. He also stressed that the rearrest of the prisoners does not hide the extent of shame Israel is going through, as Palestinian inmates have shaken their security system reputation.
No prisoner swap deal will be made without the release of our heroic prisoners who were rearrested by the occupation forces. We promise our inmates that they will be liberated soon within the no swap deal. Our inmates have exposed the fragility of the security of the enemy.
Immediately after Abu Ubaida's speech, Palestinian resistance fired rockets toward the occupied lands to show that they are ready to face the Israeli regime and defend Palestinians. In response, the Israeli airplane launched an airstrike on the Gaza Strip.
The Palestinian resistance has achieved many goals. First, it succeeded in forcing the Israeli regime out of Gaza. Second, it demolished the Zionist thought of having this land for themselves. Israeli violations and attacks against Palestinians will never terrify us.
In conjunction with this, the resistance factions held a national conference stressing the importance of the resistance.
The clashes with this Israeli regime will persist. The regime can never feel secure as long as it steals our rights and kills our people. We will never leave our prisoners alone, and the resistance will set them free.
On Saturday evening, the rearrested prisoners appeared at the Israeli court in the city of Nazareth to extend their detention while being deprived of having a lawyer. Palestinians here stress on supporting the Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails and considering them the symbol of the Palestinian issue. Palestinian factions believe that the resistance is the only way to get their rights back. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says its troops, backed by local tribes, have successfully liberated vast areas in Ma'rib. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif al-Washili, has more in this report.
Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, have successfully conducted the third phase of Operation Nasr al-Mubin. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, said Mahliya and the Rahaba directorates of Ma'rib, with an area of 1,200 square kilometers, were fully liberated. The spokesman also said over 150 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured during the operation.
The Yemeni unit succeeded in fully liberating the districts of Mahliya and Al Rahba during the third phase of Al Nasr al Mubin operation. During the operation, 151 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and a total area of about 1,200 square kilometers were liberated.
Sariya also hailed the tribes of Ma'rib for their role in supporting the Yemeni army in achieving the recent victory. Observers said the Yemeni army is now implementing the fourth phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation aimed at fully liberating all the occupied territories of Yemen.
The third phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation was a strong and important stage for the Yemeni army, which managed to liberate 1,200 Yemeni lands from the mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition. Military operations are still ongoing. And there is a fourth phase through which the Yemeni army seeks to liberate all of the northern Yemeni lands from all forms of foreign presence.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the Al-Richa province of Ma'rib from the Saudi-backed forces and terrorist groups. This move was considered as the first step forward to expel foreign forces from the rest of the country.
Yemeni tribes have repeatedly announced their opposition to the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the military will not be able to liberate the country without the backing of tribesmen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
North Korea has test-launched what it called a new type of long-range cruise missile. The country's media reported that the missile tests were carried out successfully on Saturday and Sunday. The missiles flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting their targets and falling into the country's territorial waters. The media added that the development of missiles has strategic significance as it provides effective deterrence. Pyongyang says missiles or missile capability guarantees the security of the nation and blocks military movements by hostile forces. North Korea has long accused the United States and South Korea of pursuing a hostile policy toward Pyongyang. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missile programs in return for U.S. sanctions relief collapsed in 2019. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang says North Korea's missile tests are a warning to U.S. President Joe Biden, suggesting he had better change his behavior toward Pyongyang.
Well, this sends a strong signal to the Biden administration that it better not try to treat North Korea in a hard-line manner like the former U.S. President Donald Trump did. The North had been complaining about U.S. military exercises held last month, saying that it was going to show a serious security threat after Washington and Seoul decided to go through with those drills. And everybody's been waiting for something like this to happen. On August 19th, North Korea declared a no-sail zone over its northeast waters, and everyone was expecting some sort of missile test. And then North Korea held a founding anniversary of its nation parade on Thursday, and everyone was expecting maybe South Korea would parade a submarine-launched ballistic missile or an intercontinental ballistic missile like it did at the last one in January and in October last year, especially the submarine-launched ballistic missile, which has been described as the world's most powerful weapon because it can creep up to the U.S. coastline and evade U.S. missile defenses, striking the U.S. at any point with a nuclear warhead.
In Brazil, hundreds of people have staged a protest in Sao Paulo against the president, demanding his impeachment. Protesters slammed Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. During the rally, Brazil's former health minister spoke against Bolsonaro's management of the outbreak in the country and called for his impeachment. Due to growing scandals, rising inflation, high unemployment, and the world's second worst COVID-19 death toll, Bolsonaro's approval rating has sunk to record lows. The demonstration was held days after the country marked its Independence Day with rival pro- and anti-government rallies. And that's your world news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
U.S. police violated the constitutional rights of National Lawyers Guild observers during racial justice protests in Mott Haven, a new lawsuit alleges. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nick Pinto, journalist. This article is published under the heading Legal Observers Sue NYPD Over Assault and Detention at Protest. Stay tuned for more. The rash of civil rights lawsuits against the New York Police Department as a result of its behavior during last summer's protest continues to grow, with a new suit filed on September 2nd by a group of people alleging police violated their constitutional rights during the now notorious Mott Haven kettle. Unlike many of the other suits filed so far, the dozen plaintiffs in this case weren't protesters. Rather, they were in the Bronx that day as legal observers, participants in a long-running National Lawyers Guild program that trains and equips volunteers to observe protests and document the conduct of the police who respond to them. The lawsuit describes targeted harassment and violence by the NYPD against legal observers on June 4, 2020, by rank-and-file cops, their supervisors, and the NYPD's own in-house lawyers. In the 15 months since, the police have conducted no investigation into the treatment of the legal observers, have not responded to letters from the observers' lawyers, and have insisted that there was nothing inappropriate in the treatment. The effect, says Gideon Oliver, one of the lawyers for the 12 legal observers bringing the suit, is an NYPD that has escalated its attacks on one of the vital organs of the free speech in New York City. Legal observers perform important functions when police make arrests at demonstrations. And this targeted roundup of legal NLG legal observers at a scene is something that the NYPD brass and city officials have sanctioned by refusing to do a real investigation of what happened or impose any discipline, Oliver said. It's been dead silence from the police department in response to these plaintiffs' attempts to get some transparency and accountability. The New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild has been training lawyers, law students, and legal workers to observe and document the way police respond to protests since 1968. Trained NLG observers are identified by a lanyard badge and a neon green baseball cap. During the mass arrest at the 2004 Republican National Convention, those names allowed lawyers to secure a habeas corpus writ for hundreds of protesters who were unlawfully detained by the NYPD, sometimes for days, without access to lawyers. The NYPD Patrol Guild recognizes the right of people to observe, record, and document the police and specifies that properly identified legal observers are entitled to courtesy and cooperation, including free access through police lines at the demonstrations. Observers shall be permitted to remain in any area or observe any police activity, subject only to restrictions necessitated by personal safety factors, as determined by the incident commander. None of those provisions seemed to be in effect in Mott Haven last June, however, as police rounded up legal observers along with protesters, cuffing them, throwing them to the ground, rifling through their legal notes, forcing them to sit where they could not observe the mass arrest, and police violence taking place, and coercing them to leave the scene and cease their observation of police conduct. The ostensible reason for the mass arrest was that the protest participants were breaking an 8 p.m. curfew then in effect. While this justification is undercut by the fact that the NYPD trapped protesters well before 8 p.m. and then made it impossible for them to leave, it is doubly nonsensical in the case of the legal observers who were carrying documentation confirming that the mayor's office had identified them as essential workers exempt from curfew restrictions. Video from the event shows Sergeant Kenneth Rice wearing an NYPD Legal Bureau shirt, directing officers to arrest the green-hatted legal observers. Legal observers can be arrested, he says. The NYPD often says that it deploys the in-house lawyers of its legal bureau to protest scenes to ensure that police are following the law. But civil rights lawyers contend that legal bureau lawyers often help officers violate the right of the people they are interacting with. In Mott Haven, Rice's legal direction had immediate consequences. Kirsten Hernandez, a law student at the City University of New York and one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, was working as a legal observer at the protest when they were seized by the police. Hernandez tried to show police the documents identifying them as an essential worker, but as recorded on video, police knocked the documents out of their hand and then threw them to the ground, face first, before cuffing them. Hernandez and other legal observers were rounded up and placed on the ground in a line facing away from the protest and arrest, according to the complaint. A police supervisor came over and told the group that they would have one chance to go home. "Because you don't want us to see what you are doing here right now?" one of the legal observers asked. The supervisor responded, "You know, never mind. Don't let them go." The NYPD declined to answer questions about police conduct in Mott Haven and NYPD policy with regard to legal observers. The New York City Law Department, which is representing the NYPD, the mayor, and the various individual NYPD officials and officers named in the suit, did not respond to questions by the time of publication.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to Viewpoints on IRIB English Radio. I'm Atal, the host of this program. This series of Viewpoints is concerned with the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadiq. Sheikh Sadiq, assalamu alaikum, welcome to Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum, very happy to be with you.
You're welcome, brother. And Sheikh Qasim, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in a series of the programs of Viewpoints regarding the speeches and the thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, today we want to talk about the important concept of safety, or it could be also roughly translated as security, and also calmness and tranquility inside, which these two terms or these two concepts are usually juxtaposed, come together. You know, one of the basic needs of human beings is finding peace and security. It could be on the individual level or the social level, and every person around the world wants to have a peaceful life, a life with calmness inside, a life which has no barrier, a life which has no distraction. But unfortunately, I myself believe that today's people in the world, especially in the 21st century, are very much distracted from the right path. And every day, this type of distractions and obstacles inside the human being, inside the spirit of the human being, are becoming more and more. So day by day, we are away from finding a kind of tranquility inside and peace inside. Sheikh Qasem, let's start with you, brother. So when we refer to the religion of Islam, what type of peace or what type of security are we exactly looking for?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وأهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين. I think these two concepts or notions, I believe the centric one or the one that is placed in center is tranquility and peace, and security actually is one of the manifestations, one of the instances of the way a person feels tranquil or peaceful. So this is a very important point that we have to have in mind. The second point is that we can have two perspectives with respect to peacefulness. One of them is that it's sort of internal actually feeling.
That's right.
And the second one is that it's a sort of external one. What I mean by internal and external is that, for example, you may be in a situation or a society or in a very specific situation that whatever is going around you is not a sort of secure or tranquil situation. For example, you take Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam in the day of Ashura as an example. That at that time, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was experiencing the most unsecure and untranquil situation. But at the same time, from within Imam Hussein alayhi salatu was salam, this is the report of those people around him, that the more that the Imam alayhi salatu was salam would fight in that day, the more his face become bright and happy.
The more calmness he will find and tranquility. Yeah. Because the type of, I think, peace that they were looking for in nature was very much different from the type of the peaceful movements that we see nowadays in the world.
Yeah. So this is exactly what I said, that, the situation that is going on around you is not always actually defining the way that you are feeling and you are experiencing from your within about the world.
Yes.
So this, I think this helps us to define what tranquility really and truly is. And then we have to go to the fitra again, that this one thing that is within us with respect to, having tranquility, where it's coming from, seek the place of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in our nature, that ruh, that spirit, divine spirit that has been blown into human beings, that is the source of tranquility that has to be there, irrespective of whether the outside world, the external experience that you're having is a sort of tranquil or secure
life
situation
or not. That's right. At least this pandemic, COVID-19 has shown that this type of peace or tranquility that is made around us is man-made. Okay? So a very tiny virus, in the world can remove it all. But what about the peace inside? Sheikh Sadeq, let's get to this very important aspect. Because, you know, for sure we have role models in our life. I mean, the infallibles, the ma'sumin, okay? They had a kind of peace inside. That's why it's the most difficult situation. They could bear it all and bear all the consequences. But the case is that if you want to have this kind of security and peace inside, what should we do?
Let me try to paint a complete picture about safety and tranquility and happiness. So the goal is one goal. It's closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the problem is one problem. As we said, it's حب الدنيا. حب الدنيا رأس كل خطيئة. Right? And we know from the verses of Quran that أَلَا بِذِكْرِ اللَّهِ تَطْمَئِنُّ الْقُلُوبُ. Remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings peace to the heart. And we know that أَلَا إِنَّ أَوْلِيَاءَ اللَّهِ لَا خَوْفٌ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا هُمْ يَحْزَنُونَ. We know that they're not sad, they don't have any problems, they're not afraid, they are secure.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, closeness to the big guy gives you security. Right?
Okay.
And being away from him, being close to dunya. And we also have this beautiful verse in the Surah Jum'ah. It says, قُلْ يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ هَادُوا إِنْ زَعَمْتُمْ أَنَّكُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ لِلَّهِ فَتَمَنَّوا الْمَوْتِ. So it gives us a sense of what it means to be awliyaullah, waliullah. If you think you are a friend of God, yearn for death. What does that mean?
No.
Does that mean friends of God yearn for death? They love death? Yes, because death is liqa'ullah.
Okay.
It's going back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And the opposite of death is attachment
to this world.
Attachment to dunya,
right?
So on one side we have detachment from dunya, being awliyaullah, yearning for death, being friends with Allah and being friends with death, remembrance of Allah, and all of these are synonymous with peacefulness of the heart. And on the other side, on the other end of the spectrum, we have hubbu dunya, we have attachment to dunya, and it's source of all of these anxieties and depressions and problems. And why is that so? Because of the limitedness of dunya.
That's all right.
Dunya is limited, resources are limited, and everyone is competing.
Yeah.
If you're against the world, everyone is going to take away your happiness for themselves to be happy.
And just look at the world today, man.
Yeah.
Just look at the people all around the world, how much they are taking medicines. I mean, these pills referring to the psychiatrists, following different type of therapy in order to find peace inside. And they do not find it. They do not find it, you know. And you know how much the rate of committing suicide is getting higher and higher in the world. The type of deaths the awliyaullah are looking for is very much different from the type of deaths these people are looking for, okay? I mean, that is in order to get back into the very nature of the divinity. Laqa Allah, as you said, closest to Allah. But this one, I think is because of the obstacles and our ways. And day by day, it's getting harder and harder for the people to find peace inside. Religion, especially Islam in the true sense of the world, I think Shiite Islam can help us very much. At the same time, there are some, it's better to say, systems of thoughts around the world called themselves mystical movements, that they are working in the same place. I mean, but there is a difference between these mystical movements and the religious beliefs, okay? They are giving people prescriptions too, how to find peace and to be secure inside. But if you find the peace and security inside in the true sense of the world, on that time, I think the whole world and the mechanism of the world is going to work properly. And there is no need for an exterior power to execute security and peace for the world. There would be no war. There would be no discrimination. There would be no orphan in the world. There would be no, I don't know, atomic attacks on different countries. Isn't it, Sheikh Hassan?
Yeah, actually, you brought up these mystical approaches or mystical movements that are now are sort of on a rise in the whole world. I think the difference that we can distinguish between these sorts of movements, mystical movements, and the one that the mystical or the tranquility-seeking basics that we can find in Islam is that these sorts of, you know, modern ones, they lack both the beginning, al-mabda, and the end, al-ma'ad. So this is the problem that they have. So they do not start from the mabda of this world because they don't recognize God as many of them.
Yes.
Or mostly they don't recognize God as the, you know, the creator of the world. Yes. And the beginning of the creation and being.
There is a God for them, but say live it.
Yeah.
And get to you not yourself.
Yeah, not a true one. Okay. So you are a sort of...
You are the center of everything. Okay.
Yeah, so you are the center.
Okay.
And you are everything to for this world and in this world. And you're not going anywhere, you know. So what is that? The thing is that between these two infinities or nothingness that they have, let me put not infinities but nothingness,
okay,
that they're experiencing, you try to just keep up with what is going on in the world.
Oh.
So this is what happens in, you know, these sorts of mystical approaches that they have. Contrary to what we see in Islam, that is coming up and that is starting from God, the beginning of the whole being in existence, and then going towards Him again.
Mm-hmm.
So inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. And this is the one sentence prescription of the mystical, Islamic mystical system, actually. Okay. So this is the problem.
I mean, mysticism, you mean Irfan?
By mystics, I mean Irfan, but not the in scientific way.
Scientific way.
Yeah,
you mean Irfan in the true sense of the word. Okay.
So I was watching this show. It was a sort of debate between one atheist and a theist.
Okay.
And this atheist, I don't want to call the names. So this one, she said that, you know, I've been meditating for 30 years and I feel this tranquility and things like that. And then she said, I every time that I wake up, I thank the universe. I thank. And then I give thanks, you know, to whatever is around me and things like that.
Okay.
And then that person, the theist one, he said that, who are you thanking? She said, I'm thanking the universe. He said, okay, what is this universe that you're thanking, mm-hmm, or you're thankful for and from? And she didn't have anything, you know. If this universe is just like yourself, is something that is going to perish sooner and later, so it's just, you know, a sort of stupid thing to do. What are you thanking for?
And if you ask the universe, I think, if you got a tongue and ask the universe, who are you thanking, for sure the answer will be Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, sure.
So, thank you much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Sadeq, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listener, for listening to us. To another episode, God be with you. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I'm known, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies. As
I don't need anyone,
anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Following a successful naval mission in the high seas, Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, says the country's maritime strength and reach has grown to such a level that its naval forces can now sail to any point across international waters. We now present you an article written by Mehrdad Torabi, a postgraduate student of international relations at the University of Bologna in Italy, Department of Political Sciences. The piece is titled "The Share of Iran's Navy in the Victory of the Resistance." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a message to Army Commander Major General Abdurrahim Mousavi, praised the mighty and honorable return of the 75th Fleet of the Islamic Republic of Iran's naval forces from the mission of voyaging in the Atlantic Ocean. The leader praised by saying, "Today, thank God, the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran is present on the scene with its insightful, devoted, and tireless staff, ready to fight for the noble causes of the glorious Islamic Revolution," and ordered the Navy to maintain and upgrade its capabilities. The motivation point for the Islamic Republic to empower its naval forces and capabilities vis-à-vis hypocritical promises of the so-called liberal world about peace can be traced back to a chain of events that happened between 1984 and 1988, the tankers' war during the Ba'athist regime of Iraq's invasion of Iran. Tactically defeated in front lines, the United States came to strategically help former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, who was now bombing Iranian cities and using chemical weapons against the civilian population of Iran. For America's direct intervention in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz to curb Iran's oil output failed to reverse Iran's advancement in the course of the war. The tankers' war against Iran was deliberately transformed to terrorist tactics from the part of the United States and its allies. U.S. Navy Captain Will Rogers III was awarded Legion of Merit, a medal for crime for his Persian Gulf operations, which included the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian civilian airliner, killing all 290 people on board the commercial flight. To hold out against the terrors of the U.S. empire and its hegemonic order, Iran had soon realized that the Navy had a significant, indeed a critical role to play in the future. The Iranian Navy during the post-Iran-Iraq war era countered threats not only focused on and achieved full sea control in the Persian Gulf and in the Strait of Hormuz, and also in the Sea of Oman, but it also retained the capacity for power projection and sea denial elsewhere. The 75th Fleet accomplished its task by crossing the Indian Ocean, the South Atlantic Ocean, the North Atlantic, and traveling around 45,000 kilometers across oceans and returning home. What was achieved by the Iranian Navy with the deployment of this fleet, consisting of the homemade Sahand destroyer and the Makran support ship, can be said constitutes one of the largest historical Iranian military events at sea. Not only these three concepts should be seen as a rational strategic response to the Islamic Republic's security concerns, sea denial, sea control, and power projection are directly involved in Iran's nuclear strategy. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, and its plan for action to counter the U.S. economic terrorism. The connectivity of the sea, allied to the bulk transport capacity of ships, ensures that around 96% of global trade travels by sea. Equally importantly, it offers navies the capacity to maneuver on a global scale while acting as a barrier to those unable to use it. Without a powerful naval force, it will be impossible for the sanctioned nations to withstand the U.S.'s unilateral economic siege. Iranian tankers reach South America, Syria, Lebanon, and so forth because free trade in liberal imperialism world order with its rules strictly exclusive to serve the interests of the powerful was made possible by these revolutionary forces. Following a successful naval mission in the high seas, Iran's naval commander says the country's maritime strength and reach has grown to such a level that its naval forces can now sail to any point across international waters. Iran's top naval commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, told a news conference recently, "Today we can stage a powerful naval presence throughout all maritime expanses once the relevant decree is issued." Citing the recent conclusion of a historic naval mission, he added, "Iran is the only country that provides for its own naval security." The mission saw the Iranian Navy's 75th Naval Group head out to high seas with the ultimate goal of partaking in a parade alongside the Russian naval forces in St. Petersburg. Rear Admiral Irani said, "The Naval Group recently returned to the country from the mission without finding itself in need of support from ports on its way, not even over technical matters." He hailed the flotilla's success in the mission, during which it sailed 45,000 kilometers or 24,000 nautical miles along 55 countries in three continents. According to the top naval commander, the flotilla, featuring Iran's most advanced indigenous destroyer, Sahand, and support vessel, Makran, began the mission by sailing to the northern Indian Ocean. He added, "From there on, it traveled all the way to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa." The commander said, "Turning around the Cape in the Atlantic Ocean, the mission then sought its way to the Russian port city." Rear Admiral Irani noted that the operation served to send across the message of peace and friendship to all countries that were met by the flotilla on its way. He added, "What mattered concerning the achievement was the Islamic Republic's self-confidence and competence on the international arena." The Zionist regime of Israel and its supporters knew a decisive naval power could repel the so-called maximum pressure campaign. After the United States unilaterally withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, Iran's nuclear deal with the 5+1 group, the West, in line with the U.S. imperialist objectives, resorted to confiscating and targeting Iranian shipments, undermining their own legitimacy and existential philosophy of the era of liberal enlightenment. A British oil tanker confiscated in the Strait of Hormuz when the United Kingdom seized Iran's oil shipment in an act of piracy meant that the era of the UK's naval dominance was over, and that now Iranian oil tankers could dock anywhere in defiance of US sanctions. In a way, it can be said that the Navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, both the Army and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, in addition to providing security, has also been responsible for securing Iran's nuclear deterrence strategy, as well as countering the imposed sanctions. These can be considered as pushing factors for the reinforcement of the Iranian Navy in recent years, and for this reason, the Navy has been instructed to increase its capabilities. In the meantime, with satellite technology, and as the Islamic Republic of Iran's UAV programs are transforming the region of West Asia, the Iranian Navy is increasingly looking for a joint approach with the Air Force. In addition to counting on technological developments as a solution to modern warfare, close cooperation between the air, missile, and naval forces and joint operations is expected to form a major part of the future activities of the Navy of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.